A little later this hour, I'll talk to Eli Kent about the Chans of Peer Gynt, which he has adapted. And it will be premiering at the Auckland Festival in March. Nick Bollinger's here after 10, talking about his coming-of-age memoir and playing some of the music attached to it. 7 minutes past nine, the overseas soprano joining the Auckland Chorale. Is that what we say, chorale or choral? Choral. Next week, chorale would have an E on the end. There is no E. I'm going to call it choral. Next week, for its performance of Handel's Messiah, is the multi-talented Cassandra Ekstavor, who will certainly know how to pronounce choral chorale. She's Canadian, nevertheless, but based in the United States, where she is a professor of organismic and evolutionary biology and of molecular cellular biology at Harvard University. Her specialty is germ cell development, early embryonic development. Meanwhile, Dr. Ekstavor is a classically trained soprano who could at one stage have quit the science for the music. Good morning, welcome.
Good morning, Kim.
It's You've nice been to New Zealand before, haven't you?
I have been here before a number of times.
What have you been doing here?
Well, the first time I came was probably 5 or 6 years ago for a conference in Queenstown, and then I was living here for almost all of 2015 while I was on sabbatical visiting Paul Rainey's lab at Massey University.
And what were you studying at the lab, or what were you looking at the lab about?
Well, Paul's lab, among other things, investigates themes that have to do potentially with the evolution of multicellularity or stable multicellular organisms on Earth. And that's a theme that I'm very interested in. And he works with a system that I don't work with, which are a species of bacteria. So I came to his lab to understand how they work with these bacteria and what kinds of insights we can get into multicellular evolution and development.
What do you work with?
I work with multicellular organisms, not unicellular organisms like Paul's bacteria. And the multicellular animals that we work with are all arthropods, which means that they include insects, spiders, millipedes, and crustaceans.
The big question is, I know why, and you've mentioned it in your work earlier, how the single cell organisms became multicellular organisms. Are we any closer to figuring that out?
Well, in some very strict sense, we will probably never know exactly how our current multicellular organisms that are alive on Earth today, exactly how they all came to be. But what we are closer to understanding than we were probably 50 years ago were what are the most likely processes that did occur so that single-celled organisms could come together and stay together to form a stable multicellular organism like a tree or a monkey.
For those people who are baffled by how we went so quickly from the Messiah to multicellular organisms, I should remind people that you are the Professor of Organismic and Evolutionary Biology and Professor of Molecular and Cellular Biology at Harvard University. What does organismic mean?
It means anything to do with the whole organism. And so we use that word. Some universities use the word organismal instead of organismic. I'm not clear on whether or not either of those are in the Oxford English Dictionary, but what we're trying to convey is that we're interested in understanding the organisms in their totality as opposed to just one cell at a time or just one gene at a time.
And how does your research into germ cells tie in with this?
Well, what germ cells are, they are the cells that within animals that have to reproduce sexually, like humans, for example, germ cells are the cells that will make the eggs and the sperm that are the key cells for sexual reproduction. So without germ cells, that's the one type of cell without which no species can reproduce, and therefore without which no species can even participate in the evolutionary process if they rely on sexual reproduction. So by studying germ cells, we study many things at once. We study developmental genetics, that means the genes that control what cells need to do during embryonic development. We study that process because we study the genes that tell germ cells you should be germ cells and other cells you should not be germ cells. Mm. We also study the evolutionary process when we think about germ cells because they are the cells whose DNA gets passed on from generation to generation in the evolutionary process.
But every single cell has identical genetic information and it decides to do completely different things.
Exactly right. And that is the great mystery of developmental biology. If you think that it is the most amazing and confusing and fascinating thing you've ever heard, that all of the millions of cells in our body have the exact same blueprint and yet they're all deciding to do different things with that blueprint, then you should become a developmental biologist, because that's what it is our aim to understand.
Wow. Are we any closer to that?
Absolutely, absolutely. Again, we certainly don't know all of the answers to every question in developmental genetics, but I think the field over the last several hundred years has done fairly well at narrowing down the most likely ways that cells will use to figure out how to accomplish certain tasks. For example, cellular migration, cells moving from one place to another place, is an important process in development. Cells have to move all the time. And we don't know exactly how every single cell that migrates does it, but we do know that there are basically only a handful of ways that cells can choose from when they have to get from one place to another.
What are you saying? They migrate within the organism?
That's correct. I can give you an example from normal development and an example from disease conditions. A normal developmental example is that the germ cells in most animals are first created in the embryo at a place very far away from where the testes or ovaries are going to end up. So these germ cells have to migrate, just push their way through all of the other non-germ cells to find the region where the testes and ovaries are developed, because that's where eggs and sperm are supposed to be made. So that's a process that happens in normal development. A cell migration process that happens in disease conditions is metastasis in cancer. That's when cancerous cells that are located in one place in the body break off from that cancerous tumor and migrate through the body, take up residence somewhere else, and, if we are unfortunate, may develop another tumor in this new faraway place. That's another example of cellular migration.
That first example that you gave, mm-hmm. could that be some kind of selection process going on at the cellular level?
That's a very interesting question. The answer is yes. And in fact, that very question was the subject of my PhD thesis.
Ah, and what did you, in short and brief, what did you discover?
I discovered that germ cells during their migration towards the testes and ovaries indeed were subject to natural selection at the cellular level.
And was this a surprising result, a new result?
It was a new result. This had not been demonstrated before. And it was, I think intuitively we went into the study thinking that it was very likely that this would happen because of the importance of germ cells in evolution. But until you test a hypothesis, you can't really be sure of it.
You love lab work, don't you?
I do love it.
Because why?
Because it's a chance to work independently. It's a problem-solving exercise, and I love trying to solve problems and figure out puzzles. And because you never know what you're going to get, it's always new. There's always some new excitement coming around the corner, but you don't know what it is.
You've been looking at an insect gene that somebody's called Oscar for some reason. It's a novel gene. Can you tell me more about that?
Yes, absolutely. What we mean when we say novel gene is that when we look at the sequence of the gene, the listing of amino acids that are going to make up the protein that this gene codes for, we can't tell just by looking at the sequence what that gene might be doing. Most genes in organismal genomes, we can look at them and we say, oh, that looks like a protein that's going to interact with DNA, or that looks like a protein that's going to interact with a membrane. But when we look at the sequence of Oscar, we have no idea.
And you think that it performs what kind of role then?
Well, we know that not by looking at the sequence, but by testing it by removing the gene from the organism and then seeing what the organism can no longer do, we know that in many insects, Oscar is required to make sure that germ cells exist at all. But in other organisms, it's required to make sure that the nervous system functions properly.
Oh, things are insanely complicated, aren't they?
They are complicated. I don't think they're insanely complicated, because we do have some chance of cracking them.
You don't ever feel that the more you know, the less you know?
The more we know, the more we realize how many more exciting problems there are to be solved. That's
yeah.
the way I look at it.
Okay. You had to choose at one stage between science and music, did you?
Well, I think luckily I've managed to find a way not to have to choose exclusively one to the exclusion of the other. But you're right in the sense that at every career stage along the way, I've wondered what would be the best balance of science and music to go forward with.
If you had been a full-time singer, you couldn't have done the science. But as a full-time scientist, you can still do the music. I don't know what that says about those respective disciplines.
Well, let me say that I did choose to do science full-time because I thought it would allow me to do both science and music as close to the way that I would like as possible, which is as close to being independent and being able to choose the type of science and the type of music that I do as possible. If I had done music full-time, it would have been impossible for me to choose the research problems that I work on because I wouldn't have been able to run my own research laboratory and also be a full-time musician.
No. How did that come about, your own laboratory at Harvard?
Well, the sort of path to running a research laboratory at an independent institution is to do a PhD and then to do a postdoctoral fellowship somewhere. So that means you already have a doctorate, but you can't yet be in charge of the whole lab. So you work in somebody else's lab and you try to demonstrate to them and to yourself and to the people who might hire you that you can think of new ideas by yourself, think of how to test them, and then communicate them to the community. And after a few years of that, you apply for junior investigatorships or assistant professorships, which is what I did at different universities.
But you didn't start out with this kind of research in mind. You thought you were going to be a neurosurgeon, didn't you?
Well, I never intended to practice neurosurgery, but I did have it in my mind for about a year that I wanted to train to be a neurosurgeon so that I could learn what they knew, because I thought they knew how the human brain worked.
And in fact, they have no idea. Should have been a psychologist.
Potentially. And I did think about that. But then I thought, well, but then psychiatrists and then neurosurgery, they learn not only the patterns of behavior that the human brain produces, but they also learn the chemistry and the anatomy and the physiology of the brain. So more information sounds better. So let me try neurosurgery training.
How old were you when you decided that you wanted to figure out how the human brain worked?
17.
And was there something that sparked this sudden interest?
There were a series of late-night conversations with my friend Jason from high school, where we would talk on the phone all night and discuss the behaviors of all the people in our world that we thought were crazy. Of course, we thought we could see everything very clearly and that others could not. And so we discussed the motivations, the possible motivations of people and their behavior.
I wondered whether you were more scrutinizing of people because your parents were immigrants to Canada from Switzerland and Trinidad, respectively, I think. And many people who come to a country have a more objective, investigative view of it.
Yes, that is probably true. My parents certainly because they came as outsiders to a new society and then they met and they were from different cultures as each other.
How did they meet?
They met through mutual friends at a party.
I mean, it's a pretty unusual combination, Swiss and Trinidadian.
It certainly was at that time. And I mean, the populations of Switzerland and Trinidad, respectively, are so small compared to world populations that, yes, it's a low probability meeting. But in Toronto, especially these days, you find combinations of people and families from all over the world.
There's a stereotype of the highly achieving immigrant offspring. Is that you?
You're asking me if I'm a stereotype?
I'm asking you whether you are a highly achieving offspring of an immigrant family.
I'm very proud of the achievements that I've been able to accomplish, and I definitely owe a debt of gratitude to my mother and father for, as people, and I'm sure to some extent, their view was informed by their immigrant status, encouraging us to do the very best that we could at anything that we tried.
And education was primary.
Absolutely. My parents had achieved a high school level of education, but not university education, and they definitely stressed for their children that it was important that for us to have as many options as possible, that we should achieve a higher level of education than they had had the opportunity to.
Did you ever feel pressured?
I didn't feel pressure. I wouldn't use that word in a negative sense. I felt an expectation and a responsibility and a necessity to do my best at whatever I tried to put my hand to. Simply existing without keeping in mind the world that you were in and observing it carefully and wondering if it could be made better was not an option for us. And it's not an option for many immigrant families. So we were taught, as you alluded to earlier, from a very young age, to observe the world around us, to scrutinize it carefully, and to understand where we stood in relation to that world and think about where we wanted to be and how we would, what we would have to do to get there.
So did you grow up wary?
I'm happy to use that word, but I will qualify it by saying that I don't think that wary is anything negative. I think of wary as another word for observant or having one's eyes open.
Or cautious.
Or cautious, not jumping into things without carefully observing and considering what the implications might be.
So what took you to Madrid, where I think you went and studied at the university, at the Autonomous University there?
Yes, that's right. I went to Madrid because it had the right combination of what I wanted at the time, which was to leave Canada so that I could experience living in another culture, to learn another language and try to become bilingual in another language, and to learn developmental genetics. And in Madrid, I found all of those things together.
Good Lord. You asked me earlier whether I was calling you a stereotype. You are a black Canadian, you're a child of immigrants, you are queer, you're a woman, you are a soprano, you are a molecular biologist. What part of that picture could possibly be stereotypical?
You would wonder. You would wonder.
I do wonder. I think you're possibly the least predictable in terms of characteristics and achievements.
Right.
Possible. Do you?
I mean, I haven't done the statistics on it, but it seems unlikely. But your point is very good, and it speaks to exactly what the nature of stereotypes is, because, of course, I have all these different aspects to my life, as do you, as do the producers of this show, as do all people. And yet stereotypes exist because we rarely take the time to find out all of these complex, fascinating things about each other. Instead, we see each other with our eyes if we have the gift of sight, and we quickly decide what we think this person is like, and that's where stereotypes come from.
Yeah. Yeah. I wonder whether, because everything's so busy and we've got so much to think about, we've got so much coming at us, that we more easily seize the stereotype these days. Do you think that's possible?
I think that life is busy, and the more things we invent to entertain and distract ourselves, the more of those things we consume. And you're absolutely right. To get through the things that we want to get through, we need shorthands. When I interview graduate students from my lab, I can't spend weeks with them getting to know all aspects of their personality. I might have 20 minutes to try to decide if I want to work with this student for the next 5 years. And so I need to make some shorthand guesses about what I think they will be like to work with as a graduate student. And they need to make some shorthand guesses about me quickly as to whether or not they think I would be a good advisor for them. And so we do these things. And I think our challenge as people to remain open-minded is to check whether or not we might think something about someone because they've given us evidence for that or because we're assuming that that's the case.
So always remain open to contradictory information.
Absolutely.
You went to Spain, as you said, for the language and for another culture and for the science.
Yes.
But did you sing there also?
I did sing there also. And in fact, I became very serious about singing there. I met and worked with my first serious singing teachers there, a countertenor named Carlos Mena and a vocal technician named Richard Levitt of the Schola Cantorum. And so I did a lot of singing in Spain.
This is at the same time as doing your PhD.
That's right.
Are you just more determined than most other people, do you think?
I think that because of the way I was raised, when I have something in front of me, I don't think about whether or not I want to do it. I think about whether or not I think it needs to be done. And if I decide that it needs to be done, then I do it until it's finished. And the thought of, do I feel like doing this or am I enjoying this, is secondary or tertiary to, have I decided that this needs to get done?
Wow. That's extraordinarily disciplined. I mean, discipline is the word that comes to mind. Self-discipline, huh?
Right, right.
Did you have to learn that or were you just equipped with it as you grew up?
I had to learn it as a child. It was something that was taught to us by our parents. Do you have homework? Well, then you need to do your homework. That's the end of it. Those are the only questions that need to be answered. Does this need to be done? Then you need to do it. The fact that you're bored or you feel tired or you don't enjoy it, those are not relevant issues. The issue is this needs to get done, so you need to do it. Same with dinner. It's time to eat dinner. This is the food we have for dinner. Whether or not you like it is not relevant. It needs to be eaten and you will eat it. So I was definitely raised like that, and I'm glad for that discipline now.
Do you also think that you were brought up to believe that you had to be better than other people?
Yes. Not because there was some inherent superiority to us, but
no,
because we were raised to understand that people would systematically underestimate us, very likely.
Because of the color of your skin?
Correct. And so in order to be prepared for that, we had to understand that in order to achieve certain things, we were going to have to outperform significantly other people who might not be subject to the same stereotypes as us.
Goodness. Do you have children?
I do not yet have children.
I wondered if you would tell them the same thing.
I would absolutely tell them the same thing, and I would try my best to do this in the way that my parents did, which was not to make it a discouraging or a depressing or a cynical view of the world, but simply a realistic view of the world, because my parents accompanied this message with the message that, as far as they were concerned, we were amazing people with limitless potential who could do anything we wanted and excel at it, and that the most important thing was that we be happy. And so my parents gave us this dual message, and if I am lucky enough to have children, I hope that I will be able to pass that on to them.
So when you learned to sing from the age of 17, I think,
yes,
most of it was spent in Spain.
Yes.
And then where did you go?
And then after leaving Spain, I lived in Crete for a short while, less than half a year. And then I moved to England, to Cambridge, and was there for about 5 years.
What were you doing in Crete?
I was doing a postdoctoral fellowship.
Crete seems an interesting place to choose.
Yes. Well, it was, again, a combination of wanting to live in a new place, wanting to learn a new language, wanting to learn a new field of science, which at that point was evolutionary developmental genetics. And there was some practical consideration as well. I needed to get a work permit to work in the United Kingdom, and it was most convenient that I be out of the United Kingdom while that process was happening. And so Greece seemed like a great place to go, and I was able to get a fellowship from the European Molecular Biology Organization to do that.
Are you settled at Harvard now?
I am tenured at Harvard now, and so I imagine that I will be at Harvard for the foreseeable future.
I spoke to a colleague of yours, I think, poet and critic transgender Steph Burt last week.
Yes.
I think you know them.
Yes, that's right. We coincided at a fantastic event organized by graduate students about being queer and out in academia, and Steph and I were on the panel. That's right.
Is it hard to be out in academia?
I think it depends where you are. At Harvard, we are in a self-proclaimed liberal bubble on the east coast of the United States in Cambridge, Massachusetts. And thankfully, it is not difficult to be out at my workplace at the moment.
Is that a change, do you think, from, say, I don't know, 10 years ago?
I imagine that it has, in part due to the fact that inevitably each successive generation has a different idea about what is acceptable, and every year that passes, more people from older generations retire and more people from younger generations join the faculty. And so I would imagine that things get easier as time goes on.
You singing the Messiah while you're here. Are you religious?
I am not.
So that doesn't matter?
To me, what I am doing is participating in translating the joy and wonder of an outstanding and inspiring piece of music to an audience, many of whom may not have heard the whole thing before. And the fact that it was inspired, this piece of music, on a religious faith and a set of ideas that I don't personally hold, is secondary to the joy of the music.
I was stuck in a hotel this past week due to weather. Mm. And the only thing I had to read was the Gideon's Bible.
Mm.
It's an interesting thing, the Bible.
It's fascinating.
What do you find fascinating about it?
I find fascinating any creation story generated by groups of humans over the course of human history. How do we think that our world as we know it now came to be? How do we think that we need to comport ourselves in this world? How do we think that our behavior should be informed by our past? And what kind of future do we want to make? And most major religions address these issues in some way, and it's always fascinating to me to read different groups of people's ideas about where we came from and where we need to be going.
In your scientific work, I know it's fascinating and interesting, but what do you think you could give to the world in terms of benefit as a result of it?
I think that the benefit that we can contribute is on two levels. One is the scientific level and the second is the social. So scientifically, I hope that we can bring an awareness of how we can make new and very unexpected and unpredictable discoveries when we widen the scope of organisms that we study. And socially, I hope that what my lab, which is a very culturally and ethnically diverse lab, can contribute is a new view of what science means, who can do science, who can be a scientist, and that that anyone can be a scientist.
And finally, how do you pronounce? Is it Auckland Coral or Coral?
I believe it's Auckland Coral. The administrator and staff of the organization have referred to themselves as the Auckland Coral in my presence.
And I believe that you would know what you are talking about. Based on our conversation, it's very nice to talk to you. Thank you.
Thank you very much, Kim.
Dr. Cassandra Escavor, who is here joining the Auckland Coral for the performance of Handel's Messiah.